Tom Weber at NPR News. About 15 minutes left in the hour here. We're going to open up the phones for your thoughts 1 week out. We saw the dash cam video this week. We saw the verdict last week, 1 week ago. What are you thinking about today? What are you thinking about next? 1-800-242-2828. Tracy Mumford in the studio with me, producer of the podcast 74 Seconds, which NPR News has produced and covered the case. Hello.
Hi, Tom.
Good to see you again. Brant Williams, NPR News reporter based in Minneapolis. Brant, good to see you as well.
Hey, nice to see you, Tom.
Tracy, you were sitting in on that interview last night. You've had a week to go through everything. Just what are you thinking about today? What are you thinking about, like, other questions out there? Where do we go from here?
Yeah, no, it's just interesting. We've only heard from three jurors at this point. There were 12. So it's just like piecing together what happened in the juror room that led to this verdict, because I think a lot of people still have questions about the verdict.
Brant, you've covered a lot of policing, shootings and the like. I think you went to a training recently with police in Eagan. As these conversations have been had, are we doing the same exact thing that we did after Jamar Clark? Are we doing the same exact thing we've done after policing incidents or conversations? Or is there something different about just what you've seen the last week here from Philando?
Yeah, I think there's definitely something different. Number one, because this case went to a trial. There were charges. Mm-hmm. Unlike with Jamar Clark's shooting, those officers were exonerated of any criminal charges. And so in this case, we got this very public viewing of how you decide the guilt or innocence of a police officer who is involved in a fatal shooting. And as the juror was mentioning, the law was what they had to follow, the law that was given to them by the judge. And that can sometimes clash or at least sound kind of funny to people who have not been in the courtroom, haven't listened to mm-hmm. all the evidence, and haven't had a chance to, and they did not receive those jury instructions. So I think it's been a learning experience. I think it's been very, very valuable in a lot of ways, and that people get a chance to see why maybe it is that you don't see very many more convictions or charges brought against police officers, because those prosecutors mm-hmm. only bring charges, or they say they will only bring charges unless they know they can get a conviction. And this case, I think, was maybe just one of those examples of why it is so tough to get a police officer convicted of these types of charges.
Let's go to the phones here as we open it up for here about 15 minutes or so. One of the people we actually talked to on Monday after the verdict had come out was John Thompson, who is a friend of Philando Castile's, was in the courtroom for the trial and the like. And it turns out he's been listening to this interview this hour as well. So, John, I'm glad you called back. It's good to hear from you again. What are your thoughts here today?
Oh, man, Tom, we're still hurt, man. We're still hurt.
Yeah.
Still grieving, sad, mad. My overall thoughts was from the beginning, I said that we never had a judicial system. So we kind of just hope for the best and prepare for what we saw coming.
Yeah. Thoughts from the – what have you thought about the jury? I mean, the comments there about – go after the law, don't go after the people. I mean, what are your thinkings about that kind of a comment?
You're absolutely right, Tom. That juror is absolutely right. I actually noticed that with this legislative session, just because I was very active. That's who we do have to attack. We have to attack, like, Peter Zerhoff and the Cornish in these legislative sessions. Those are the ones who pass these bills and these laws and these house files. So we have to come after them, because what they tell us is that it's all right for that type of behavior that Yanez displayed. The type of behavior is acceptable. It's the law. So me being a 6'3 African-American man, they're telling me if I'm standing up and I'm yelling at an officer, Yanez, he can shoot me. I don't have to have a weapon. He can shoot me, and it's accepted. It's the law behavior.
John, your phone is breaking in and out, but I heard what you had to say there, citing lawmakers you've talked to. Tony Cornish is the chair of the Public Safety Commission in the House. Sorry we cut you off there. The phone wasn't great, and I want to get to a couple other calls. But just quickly, have we heard about, you know, and maybe the podcast goes this avenue in the future. I mean, do we think about this legislatively? I know the session's over, but what are your thoughts, Tracy?
Yeah, we could see people, now that they understand the role that the law played in this verdict, mm-hmm. People pushing for change. That's something that we could see. The podcast will continue to cover this. The verdict came down, but the story for a lot of people isn't over.
John, thanks so much for calling. Let's take some more calls if we can here before the end of the hour. Neela is in Minneapolis. Hi, Neela. What are your thoughts here today?
Well, I heard that question that you had posed about, you know, people's reactions after taking all of this in and after the dash cam video came out. And after listening to several interviews now with different jurors, I'm comfortable with the verdict. I understand legally why that may have been appropriate. But something that I really struggle with is just that in comparison with other professionals in dangerous careers, like security guards, military, ER nurses, and other, you know, healthcare professionals who have a high risk of assault, they have to meet a much higher standard before being able to use force. I mean, there has to be a standard of proof that the person is a danger to them, or to a danger to themselves. And it seems like there's been a change in police culture that standard no longer has to be met. It is just now the perception of fear on part of the officer. It doesn't actually have to be a reasonable fear. Yeah. And I don't understand that. That's something I'm really struggling with in relation to this case.
Neela, thanks for the call, Brant. You've done a lot of reporting about police training. The story in the Star Trib today has an article about that as well. We've covered that as well. Where do you see police training going? Is there going to be a paradigm shift at all?
You know, I'm not sure about that, but you know, to the concern about this, the officer's fear being seen as a justifiable reason for using excessive force, and this was brought up in many of the trials that I've covered of officers who have been accused of using excessive force, that there are essentially, it seems, two standards of justifiable force. If you're a citizen, you know, you're out on the street and, you know, you fear for your life and you draw a weapon and you shoot and kill somebody. There's that standard. And police officers who do receive training are held to a standard of any reasonable officer who, if this situation is somewhere where a reasonable officer would fear for their lives, that use of force is justified.
Also want to bring in just one quick news item. Tracy, I know you've seen this, but it has to do with Twin Cities Pride. There had been this, because of the verdict, because of feelings in community, Twin Cities Pride had originally, at one point this week, said, we don't want police, other than the basic security, to be involved with the parade. But they've actually changed that with an apology today. There's a statement on their website to say that we would like to have them as part of the Twin Cities Pride tomorrow. So that is a tangential news story, but you can read more about that at nprnews.org. Aaron's on the phone, happens to be from Alaska, but is visiting here in the in Minnesota. Aaron, what are your thoughts?
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question was, during the on the dash cam recording, as they were driving up to pull Castile over, Yanez mentions his wide-set nose as a reason for suspecting he was a robber. And so that just smells, you know, strongly of racial profiling and violation of, you know, search and seizure, right, that amendment. So therefore, his entire, like, times of pulling him over was illegal, an illegal stop. Mm-hmm. And how does that color the rest of his, you know, in the rest of the interaction? And the second question is, based on the last call, I'm former military, and in Iraq, I've never been employed, but, you know, I've talked to people who have been. Like, the threshold for using deadly force, you know, is positive identification of a weapon, right? You have to see the weapon clearly, and it has to be intent to use it, right? And so that, if in a war zone, the threshold is higher than in, for a person sitting in his car as a civilian, that just, you know, blows my mind. It's easier to kill a civilian than it is to kill a potential militant in a war zone. Yeah, so those two questions are
Aaron,
on my mind.
Thanks for the call. The juror, as we noted, I recorded that last night, so he's not here now. But have you heard anything, Tracy, about that first question, especially because the comment was made by Officer Yanez when he was talking before he went up to the car about the wide-set nose and the question of racial profiling?
So both the prosecution and the defense during the course of the trial had their separate use of force experts on the stand who provided opposite opinions, obviously, on what happened that evening about the reasonableness of Officer Yanez's behavior. And they did address the stop itself, whether the stop was reasonable. The state's case, their experts said it was not reasonable, that Philando Castile was a guy who just happened to be driving by, and versus the defense's use of force expert said the opposite, that the stop itself was reasonable. So the jury did hear conflicting testimony about the nature of the stop itself.
Matt is in St. Paul. Hi, Matt. Your question here today.
Hi. This hasn't been brought up very much. I've been thinking it from the beginning, but in the state of Minnesota, if you are a legal carrier of a handgun, if you have the license to carry concealed, you do not have an obligation to inform a police officer that you have a handgun on you unless you are asked specifically. Now, it's different in other states, but Philando went above and beyond his legal requirement to make this officer feel comfortable by telling him, I have a handgun. And to me, that would show that he had no intention to do harm by trying to set the officer's mind at peace. And then seconds later, you know, we're in this situation.
Matt,
now what?
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We only have a minute left, but I just want to jump in there because, Tracy, I think you have a story about this. This afternoon that gets into this, actually.
That's right. It is voluntary. And so firearms instructors in Minnesota who I've spoken with have differing instructions for their students. Some instructors will say, yes, you should disclose. You should say you have a firearm. You should say you have a permit first thing. Lucky Rosenblum, who there's no official record of this, but he believes he is the only African-American firearms instructor in the state, says he tells his students to never declare that they have a firearm first thing unless they are directly asked, that it's completely voluntary and they should not volunteer that information. He says he's teaching that. He says he teaches his courses from the Black perspective, and that is a key part of what he teaches his students. So it's up to gun owners.
That'll be online this afternoon, right? NPRnews.org. Michael in Wells, Minnesota. Hi, Michael. Your thoughts here today. We have about a minute left, so
yes,
go for it.
I'll talk quick. Yeah, my brother was pulled over a couple of weeks ago. He's white. The cop noticed that he had a concealed weapons permit. My brother said, yes, I have a gun. The whole stop, the cop joked around. He never called for backup. He never asked where the gun was. He ended up letting my brother off with a warning, you know, for the speeding. I mean, it was handled totally different, you know, and whether it was, I can't say that it was because he was white or we're in rural Minnesota, but the stops were totally different. My brother was alone, you know, it wasn't like he had his kid in the car or his girlfriend, you know, it was just handled totally different. Mm-hmm.
Michael, thanks for the call. Thanks for the perspective. And thanks to everybody who called here at the end of the hour as we mark 1 week since the verdict. Tracy Mumford, producer of NPR News' podcast called 74 Seconds. I invite you to download it, subscribe it. There'll be more episodes coming. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Brant Williams, NPR News reporter. Thank you for your time as well.
You're welcome, Tom. Thanks.